behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is Car Stuff. My name is Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And today, Scott, before we get started, got a little anecdote for you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, if I may.
Of course.
So, there I am, driving from Florida back to Atlanta, and I'm using my girlfriend's car.
Okay.
You know, and she says, we're going a long way. Turn on the cruise control. And I say, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I don't really, like, I get cruise control. I know it's personal preference, but I would rather be actively engaging with the road. I kind of don't trust cruise control.
I understand.
You know what I mean? And, she said, no, you know, it's better for the mileage. You'll feel better, blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, you know, lady, this is not my first rodeo.
You didn't say lady. I hope not, Ben.
I did say it.
Lady, I have a rock solid foot on this accelerator. Back it down.
I did say lady, but in a joking tone. Yeah. I wasn't in the outdoor doghouse.
Not yet.
But the story goes on. Anyhow, we get to, on our way back, we get to this part where it's where the lanes of the interstate narrow and it's crowded, right?
You're a bottleneck.
It's a bottleneck, absolutely. And people are driving crazy. You know, you've always got that one character who wants to tailgate everybody and not use turn signals to swerve back and forth right in front of tractor trailers and truckers. You guys listening, I know that you probably saw one of those people today, and you're right. They're bad, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's all just to get like two or three cars ahead.
Right. And then, yeah, and so I'm getting annoyed in the traffic, and then my girlfriend is saying, you know, you wouldn't be annoyed if you had had cruise control on. And I said, what? That doesn't make any sense. And she said, well, you know, because then this would be the first time in like 2.5 hours that you would have to worry about stopping and starting. And then I said, no, it's just the traffic jam. Stop this. No, I.
What a strange argument.
What a weird argument.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. But it got me thinking, about cruise control in general, because some people love it.
Yeah.
Some people hate it, and, they do so for different reasons. But it also brings us to, like, this episode is not just about car control, guys. This brings us to a much larger concept, which is how much do you want your car to do for you?
Yeah, how automated would you like your vehicle to be, really? You know, what do you want it to do for you that you normally do manually at this point? That's that's the point, right?
Yeah, especially in this brave new world of future cars, right?
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you, Ben. I don't think I've touched the cruise control button on my car for, 5 years?
Yeah.
Maybe? I mean, I just don't use it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the traffic situation. There's never a place where there's just enough road to be able to use cruise control, you know, in front of me. It's always, you know, bumper to bumper traffic, you know, on the way to and from work. When we do take the road trips or whatever, it's still relatively crowded on the roads. There's a lot of traffic in this area.
Right.
I mean, even getting to and from, you know, the county that Atlanta is in, it's still crowded all around it. I mean, once you get out of that area, then the roads become mountainous almost, you know, like we're driving through the mountains. And
sure.
I don't know if cruise control is really the best to be able to, you know, feature to use in the mountains because, you know, it just doesn't seem like a safe thing to do. I mean, you don't want to be going 80 all of the time.
Right.
You know, through the mountains. That's not a good plan.
Well, here's my deal. It feels like, and this is all a personal preference, I understand completely the objective advantages of cruise control. However, on a subjective note, it feels a lot less like driving and a lot more like I'm just steering.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it.
Now I can play a video game at home, Scott.
Just along for the ride at that point.
Yeah,
right?
Okay. I'm just some jamook with a wheel.
Well, you know, we're talking about automatic features and you know how automated you want things to be, and really when we talk about cruise control, that's really not even the end all, I guess, of cruise control types, because there's active cruise control, you know, or adaptive cruise control,
right,
and that's really what we're talking about is, you know, systems that, you know, you can take it even one step further with, you know, like, I guess an example would be automatic headlamps or climate control, or, you know, we mentioned cruise control, but what about automatic wipers that, you know, when it senses rain on the windshield, they wipe your windshield.
Yeah.
Things like that. And there's more to it than just that, you know, just those three or four. But I wanted to point out those four because there's a blog post that I read recently, Ben, that, this guy who wrote this blog post, and it's from the No But Seriously blog.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by a guy named Chris out of Salt Lake City, Utah. And he was talking about, the very ones I mentioned, you know, the automatic wipers, the headlamps, and the climate control. But then he also had a very scary situation pop up with, active cruise control. In a rental vehicle.
Right.
And that's kind of where we want to go with this is that, you know, there's some situations that can arise with these automated systems that you may not think about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we've got a little bit of an excerpt here, right?
Yeah, that's right. If you like, I can just kind of read along here through his blog post and we can talk about it as we go.
I would love a dramatic reading by Scott Benjamin.
Well, what I'll do is I'll summarize the beginning part here because, you know, there's a lead in and then there's the actual story I want to get to, okay, where the complications begin.
Okay.
All right. So, the guy's talking and just, again, this is from, I think February. So it's pretty recent. But he says, my current ride has all the conveniences you'd expect nowadays, you know, auto lights, auto wipers, climate control, et cetera. But the longer I own the car, the less I find that I'm using all of these things. You know, I turned the auto lights, off on day one. And fortunately, he says, the off position on my car is truly off, not like most of the Ford and GM products where the off switch means auto. You know, like the light switch is pretty much pointless at that point.
And right.
I think you've been maybe in a rental car that's done something like that. We don't, neither you or I drive the GM or Ford products, but, sorry, you do drive a GM product, but it doesn't have auto lamps, right?
Right. Mine does. The Monte Carlo in that gen does have the auto lamps.
No kidding. So you dealt with this frustration then.
So
I didn't know that, Ben. I didn't know it had auto lamps, but the light switch is actually a pointless light switch then at that point, right?
Yeah. It's not going to turn stuff off if it's after dark.
That's crazy. So you turn it off and they still work whenever it becomes dark enough for the lights to come back on, right?
Yeah.
Weird. All right. So, anyways, let's move past this. The auto wipers, it says, you know, took a lot of getting used to at that point, but he says, I've actually turned those off at this point as well because they were kind of driving him crazy. You know, he knows when it's raining, you know, obviously it's not a difficult thing to switch on and off. So a lot of people feel that way. He does, however, use climate control because it's pretty nice to be able to set it at one temperature and just forget about it, which I can understand.
Right. And that just affects driver comfort. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't affect the road or mechanic, you know, it doesn't affect the actual drive until we're talking extremes of temperature.
And he makes one really astute, comparison here, I think. He compares this to his house.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, okay, well, of course I turn the auto lights off and I turn the auto wipers off because my house doesn't turn the lights on when it gets dark.
Uh-huh.
And the windows don't clean themselves when it rains. But the climate control, I've got a thermostat that does the exact same thing in my house, and I'm accustomed to that. I'm accustomed to the temperature being the same, whether it's warm or cold. You know, there's something automatically that takes care of that for me, and I don't have to keep fidgeting with the dials in order to make it work. So that made perfect sense. Now, here we're getting to the part of the story where there's a little bit of trouble that happens. Now, he rented a car in the United Kingdom over Christmas. And the car had something called active cruise control, and this is in a luxury crossover vehicle called the Volvo XC60. And he says, and I'll censor this.
Yeah.
It scared the crap out of me, because its idea of what it called a safe following distance is way shorter than I'd like when I drive. And I'm not exactly known for leaving a large gap in front of the car in front of me, in the car in front of me rather. But let's put it this way. I've never had a full-on panic attack in a car ever until I got into that rental car. So he's trying out this active cruise control system. And right away, the thing is gauged or is metered to give a safe following distance that is a lot tighter than he's normally accustomed to.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said, of course, just so we know, let's go ahead and tell people, in case you don't know what adaptive cruise control is.
Sure.
Normal cruise control, you activate it and set it to a minimum speed, a minimum MPH. And so you set it to 55 or whatever, or most people would probably set it to like 5 over the speed limit. Mm-hmm. And then you just cruise and it will maintain that speed. If you hit the accelerator, then it will up to, you know, it'll accelerate, and wherever you stop it is where it's going to stay. If you push the brakes, it automatically turns off as a safety feature.
Yeah, I mean, the brake thing is universal. I think that there's differences in the way that it accelerates. There's also something that you can push that will up at 5 miles per hour at a time.
At an increment, yeah.
Exactly right. So they're a little bit different in that way, but you're right, Ben. You can override it every time with the brake pedal.
Right. And so with active or adaptive cruise control, you hear them called different names, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of times it just depends upon the manufacturer of the vehicle. But the concept, at least for this Volvo, is that the Volvo will sense the cars in front of it, sense the bodies, the matter and space before it, and will adapt to that proactively. So without the driver's interference or participation, this Volvo will just follow along at the speed of the traffic flow, right?
At the set distance that you have it programmed in for, right?
At the set distance that it is programmed for, because it doesn't sound like this guy got to program it in the rental.
It doesn't sound like it, and I thought that was something that you could kind of dial and adjust, but maybe not.
I mean, there's an ability to
do so. There probably is. Maybe he wasn't aware of it. Maybe it doesn't exist in that vehicle. I don't know. Maybe there is just a one set safe following distance that they have.
So it sounds like... It sounds like what he's saying is that this Volvo was tailgating the crap out of people.
That's what it does sound like. So, you know, he says that, you know, already I was a little bit nervous about it because of the safe following distance thing. And he says, I'm deeply untrusting of this type of technology.
Right.
So he hovered his foot over the brake pedal, the entire time, you know, just to make sure that, you know, things don't go awry here quickly because, you know, I guess it would be a little odd, you know, odd to, see a car slow down in front of you and not have to do anything, you know, the first time you're accustomed to, or first time you're trying to use this type of system. So here's where the problem really begins. About an hour into the journey, we came across the usual traffic blockage, and traffic slowed, and the Volvo began to slow accordingly, so it's working the way it's supposed to go, right? And he says, well, that's really clever, of course, and it worked fine. But the car started to shift in lanes, and the guy in front of me, he changed lanes too, but I stayed where I was. And, you know, when you get into a line, I guess it makes no difference what line you're in. You're going to be stopping at some point, right? I mean, because there's a tie-up there. So he says, then came my, and I'll paraphrase this again, my oh crap moment.
Right.
When the Volvo beeped at me and a little orange car symbol appeared on the dash. And he later found out that meant that the adaptive system had lost the car in front of the vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
So it didn't know what was happening. You know, it just the car had switched lanes abruptly.
And then it gone out of its sensing distance.
Exactly right.
Right.
And now there's a gap in front again, but you got to remember there's also cars piled up in front of him that are coming to a stop quickly. So the Volvo at this point, you know, it lost the vehicle.
Yeah.
It begins to accelerate back to the preset cruise speed, which could be big trouble, right?
Yeah.
Approaching a line of vehicles. So, you know, the red following distance warning light comes on quickly, and the Volvo then swaps from accelerating to hard braking, and it brakes harder and harder until eventually he just decided to stomp on the brake himself because he was utterly convinced that at that point he was going to have a guaranteed crash. That's how serious this was. So you got to picture this. I mean, they're driving along. Everything's fine. They start to slow down. Still fine.
A little closer than he'd like.
A little closer. The car moves out of the lane. The Volvo says, there's lots of space. I'm going to just jut ahead here, you know, because there's clearly open road ahead, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the problem was then once it did sense another vehicle in front, it starts to brake extremely hard. So it's accelerating, braking harder, harder, harder. And then he finally gave up and took over manual control.
I guess the most way to – let's keep our censorship theme going. The Volvo went ape crap. And warning beeps and alarms are going off across the dash.
Mm-hmm. And it says they pitched violently forward, mm-hmm. and all kinds of dash lights are coming on, and it's a scary situation, right?
And it's all in the space of 3 to 4 seconds, because as we know, when an accident happens, it's unexpected, it's quickly, and it all took less than 3 to 4 seconds. So as we all know, when an accident occurs, things move so very quickly. Sometimes your perception of it, you may have an experience that time slows down or something, but that's inaccurate. And most people don't make good decisions, but simply because they don't have time to. So this guy got pretty lucky, and he mentions that he's used to riding a motorcycle. So mm-hmm. he's not as easily shaken, perhaps.
Yeah, he said something about, you know, adrenaline-induced shakes that he was having after this because it happened so quickly and it was so jarring to him. And he said, you know, I don't scare easily. Because the motorcycle that I ride on, I'm accustomed to being nearly killed all the time when I ride my bike, you know, because drivers just don't see motorcycles. So they get in front of him. He knows what that shot of adrenaline feels like. And he doesn't get it all the time anymore because he just knows to expect it. He said this situation really, really shook him. And, you know, it's not necessarily that, and the Volvo system was working the way it was supposed to.
Right.
It's just, it didn't have that, that lead time like it should. Like maybe it needs a greater, following distance, or maybe it was dialed out and he just didn't know it, or I don't know what's going on here, but
yeah.
You know, it's a good point that, you know, this story, this blog here really points out that, you know, you can think that this thing is in control and everything's fine, but then suddenly something happens and, you know, it's a unique situation.
Right.
That throws it into a tailspin.
Well, yeah, there are clearly some first responses that the engineers can make if they haven't already to increase the sophistication of that automated system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, a bigger sensory field,
mm-hmm.
Somehow an awareness of the forest of cars instead of just the individual trees,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's got to be a much more advanced system.
I imagine it's much more complicated. It may also require outside sensory stuff like, you know, Audi's automatic parking feature needs a parking deck with an infrastructure that speaks to the car, for lack of a better word.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, the Google cars are working on something like this. You know,
right.
They're very advanced as far as the way that they're able to monitor traffic far, far ahead. I wonder why that technology hasn't crept into some of the current vehicles that have these types of systems. But again, these are the earlier versions of it. I mean, we'll probably see that creep into it eventually.
Yeah, but this could be just an early technology.
And we're not picking on Volvo by any means, because there's a lot of cars that have this type of system. And again, that was an unusual situation, and I can kind of understand how that would happen. Until it picks up that second vehicle in front of it, why wouldn't it think that there's open road ahead?
I'm telling you, man, I don't trust cruise control. It's Skynet.
You know, there's a lot of things that I don't trust as well, and I want to get to a short list of them as we move on here. But, you know, let's mention a couple of other types of technology. And I don't want to pick on adaptive cruise control either.
No, we spent a lot of time on cruise control.
Yeah, there's more than that, too. And do you remember, I just want to bring this up one thing here. Another automated system that I mentioned a while back. I have a friend who drives a BMW, a newer one, that every time he gets into that car, it has the start-stop technology.
Yeah.
And he said, every time I get into that thing, he said, I hate the start-stop technology, and I couldn't get the car without it, so I had to have it. And he said, I just absolutely hate the system, and it's not anything about BMW. I just don't like the feeling of, you know, the car stopping at a light. It's you know, disconcerting. You know, it's like, well, is it going to start again? And it always does. But every time he gets in, he pushes the button. I think you have to push and hold the button to shut it off. And he does that every time, and if he forgets it, it's like, you know, at the first light, the car stops again. The car, it seems like it dies. It dies again. And he's like, oh, jeez, I got to set that. So he does it right then. You know, he turns it back on again.
So, so for our listeners who don't know what start and stop technology is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what that is that, you know, at a stoplight or a stop sign or whatever, if you're going to be stopped for more than 2 seconds, you know, the engine shuts off, saves fuel, and then the engine picks back up again as you press the accelerator. It's a lot like the old golf carts worked.
Uh-huh. In theory, a fantastic idea, but I can also see how it's annoying because, how embarrassing would it be if your brand new BMW actually breaks down at a light and you think, oh, it's just starting and stopping.
You know, it just seems like once something's running, just let it run. Doesn't it seem like that? I mean, and I have to make, I'll be honest, on my way home, I mean, as many times as I push in the clutch on my car and start and stop, you know, traffic on the way home,
yeah.
I must push the clutch in on my car. Ben, this is no exaggeration, like 300 times on my way home from work, and it's only about 15 miles. It's a short, short drive, but it is so backed up with traffic on the way home in the evening that it's literally like 300 times that I'll push it, maybe 300 to 400 times.
Wow.
It hurts your left leg after a while.
That makes sense because you're constantly having to switch speeds.
Yeah, but imagine the engine having to start and stop that many times as well. Now, that seems like that would just lead to trouble.
There are, as we go through this episode, I think we should also point out that there are clear objective pros to these automatic things. Some of it comes down to preference. I remember that my grandfather, when when they were trying to save money on gas, he apparently, one of his tricks was, this was in Tennessee, right? So there are mountainous roads everywhere. Mm-hmm. If they were going somewhere where they knew there would be a lot of mountains, once they got to the part of town where it's generally downhill, mm-hmm. they would turn the car off and it would just go down.
And this is before like locking steering wheels.
Oh, it's before all of it.
But, you know, no power brakes, nothing like that.
No.
That's crazy. Man, that's dangerous. That's like a hypermiling technique.
It is.
Well, he was way ahead of his time.
I'm just glad that I somehow was born.
You made it through that.
Yeah, he clearly had some priorities, and safety wasn't one of them.
You know, I've got a couple here that there's some pros, I guess, if you want to hear a couple of pros.
Yeah, let's do some pros.
Because I feel like we're being pretty negative about some of this stuff.
We started kind of negative.
Let me list a couple of pros here. Now, it says, you know, there's some of this, like, modern crash avoidance type features that you know, just don't simply have the stats to back them up yet. So,
like collision detection type stuff.
Well, even the adaptive cruise control and adaptive headlights and backup cameras and things like that, they don't have quite enough data to be able to say that we're really helping drivers at this point. But there are two exceptions to this. And systems that can help drivers to avoid front to rear end collisions, which we're talking about in, you know, the traffic situations like we've just mentioned.
Right.
The two that are really, really key to this are automatic braking systems and adaptive headlights, of all things, Ben.
Hmm.
Adaptive headlights. Now, I wouldn't think that, but this comes from a guy named David Zuby, and he is the chief research officer at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, or IIHS.
Uh-huh.
And he cites a study that comes from a report that comes from its sister organization called the Highway Loss Data Institute. And I guess that, the research from this study indicates that those two systems, those two features in particular, are definitely worth whatever extra cost they are on the vehicle. If you can get a vehicle that has automatic braking and adaptive headlights, apparently that will actually save you, it will help prevent front to rear end collisions.
Well, we can make a case for adaptive headlights, and I'll tell you why. A surprising and somewhat disappointing amount of drivers forget to put their headlights on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, everybody has these unspoken rules of thumb. Every single driver has some sort of set of commandments that they believe every other driver should know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you are driving in the U.S., then the left lane is the faster lane,
mm-hmm.
and it is for passing, not Sunday strolls.
Got it.
And then another idea would be the use of turn signals.
What's that?
Well,
I'm kidding.
Yeah, right. You should always use a turn signal. I feel like some people are afraid that their cars come preloaded with a certain amount of turn signals and they don't want to run out.
Yeah, it seems that way, doesn't it?
There's a joke in there somewhere. But when it comes to the idea of headlights, a lot of people don't agree on when you should turn on your headlights.
Well, sure. What if it's 1 p.m.? And it's a little bit dark out because it's raining.
Yeah, it's overcast all day, and now it started raining.
Some people believe if there's any rain falling at all, you turn the headlights on, and I think that's a pretty good rule to follow. But also, some people say, like, well, I'm not going to turn my headlights on until the sun is actually over the horizon.
Until it's actually dark.
It's actually dark. Not a moment before that, I'm not going to turn them on. But others say I'm going to have mine on all day long because it's safety.
Right. And some insurance companies give you a discount on your auto insurance if you have an adaptive thing.
Know, I'm going to talk later. I want to mention something about daytime running lamps later in the program. But, the thing is, like, with headlamps, like, everybody's got their own little rules but no one has any rules about, like, braking and things like that mentioned. So, you know, the one thing that I want to get back to here is on this list from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, there's a couple of eight different safety features that you can consider on new vehicles. And I'm not going to list all of them, but two in particular I wanted to point out here. These two work together. The forward collision avoidance system, which is kind of what we were talking about with the adaptive cruise control, right?
Yeah.
That's similar. You know, that's where, you know, like anything that will alert drivers, I guess, or give them a visual or auditory cue that something is approaching too quickly, you know, towards the front of your vehicle, or you're approaching too quickly towards the back of their vehicle, however
right,
you want to put
it.
And then autonomous braking, you know, because these two work together. So, you know, something that the driver doesn't have to do. If the driver doesn't respond to the warning from the forward collision avoidance system, then the autonomous braking kicks in. And I guess, you know, that these two systems together, when they combine, you know, that makes a pretty solid system. The way they work together, you know, the collision avoidance system with the autonomous braking. If you're in a traffic situation, you know, where, you know, the adaptive cruise control is kind of doing something that's kind of squirrely, you know, this is like another backup. And then I guess the other one would be, hey, pay attention. You know, that's the other thing,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's kind of what we're getting to is that, you know, I've got a whole list here, Ben, and I kind of want to read this if you don't mind. It's mm-hmm. maybe more on the negative side, though. I don't know.
I tell you what, before we do, let me tell you something that I do love cars.
What's that?
I love the ability to be able to listen to the radio, especially, you know, I've been breaking some Ben Bolin rules of thumb and going on vacations like wild man
and
stuff.
You're getting all over the place.
I'm getting around, and I mean, in a good way. It's a family show. one of the things I'm finding is that the radio can be so repetitive. I love NPR. I love hearing good stories. You are on the forefront of audiobooks nowadays.
I am, because, you know, the radio stations fade as you drive out of town, right?
Right.
Exactly right. And then you just never know if you're going to be able to pick anything up. And I'd like to listen to something continuously and just know that it's going to be there. And it's nice to be able to start and stop something. You know, when you make stops around town, or if you're on a long road trip, you can pull into the gas station, get back in, and pick up the story exactly where you left off.
Love it.
Love that about audiobooks. Now, here's a good one. It's called The Limit: Life and Death on the 1961 Grand Prix Circuit.
Oh,
and,
okay.
This is a good one. It's from Michael Cannell, and it's 8 hours and 18 minutes, so not exceedingly long, but not short either.
Yeah.
You know, reasonable road trip book. And let's give you a quick summary.
Lay it on me, brother.
It's pretty interesting. All right, this is about Phil Hill, who was, as they say, a lowly California mechanic who, defying all expectations, became the first American to win the Grand Prix Championship in 1961. And this high-octane narrative evokes the lives of daredevils who tempted fate each Sunday by driving well over 150 miles per hour without the benefit of seatbelts or roll bars in their cars. Now, I don't know if you remember or if you've ever seen Formula One footage from this time, but it's so weird. These guys have like tiny little bench seat.
Yeah.
I mean, a single seat bench seat.
Yeah.
They climb in and they're sitting up way high in the car with no roll bar around them or anything. No seatbelt. They just grab the wheel and go. It's amazing. It's really, it's unbelievable that that's the way it was even in the early 1960s. Now, it's written with the pacing of a novel, and The Limit puts Hill against his Ferrari teammate, German Count Wolfgang von Trips, as they jockey for the top spot around the 1961 season, culminating in one of the deadliest races in Grand Prix history. And we talked about this specific race.
We did, yeah.
Now, do you remember when we talked about racing at Monza?
Mm-hmm.
Is it letting anything out of the bag? Should I tell them what happens at Monza?
Go ahead and say it.
All right, I'll say it because, you know, the whole book leads up to this. I'm not really giving anything away. It's history.
Yeah.
There were a total of three driver deaths in the year of 1961, so it was already a pretty bad year for Formula One drivers. But the final race was the most deadly, when von Trips collided with Jim Clark at Monza, and it killed the Ferrari driver and 14 spectators.
Yep, it hit the crowds.
It's amazing. I mean, you can see footage of that event happening. It's terrifying to see. But all right, Ben, so I think this is a book that that our listeners are going to find interesting. I mean, it's just loaded with racing history, and it's all about the 1961 Formula One season and everything around it. You know, the behind-the-scenes activity. Phil Hill, of course, interesting story.
Wolfgang von Trips is a real name.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which
is
still the most incredible part of that story.
That's a cool name.
And there's some good news about not just this story, but every audiobook offered by Audible.com. Just for knowing your buddies over here at Car Stuff, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/carstuff, sign up for a free audiobook download of your choice. And that is no wooden nickel kind of offer, because audiobooks can be a little bit pricey, especially the longer ones.
Some of these can be up in the $30 range. So this is a pretty good deal. I don't know exactly what this one is valued at, but, you know, learning about the 1961, you know, season, I think is worth, you know, just signing up, right?
And yes, absolutely. And here is an interesting segue into this for our episode, because, you know, when radios first started becoming commonplace on cars, there were concerns that radios would increase car accidents.
Too distracting, right?
Yeah, too distracting.
It's funny to think, but like maybe the radios had kind of the stigma, I guess, associated with them as cell phones do now.
Right. You know, what are you doing? Texting. You're trying to listen to bluegrass and you're going 17 miles an hour, you monster.
Yeah, that's crazy. What are you? You're out of control out there on the roads. I can see it.
You're driving like a Welshman, you fool.
That's right. So I've got a short list of things, and I mean, I hate the way that I sound when I read these, Ben, but I'm going to sound like an angry old man, I guess.
Okay. This is the get off my lawn part of our podcast.
I guess so. And I'm going to skip around on this list a little bit because, you know, this is something I found a list called the, from something called the Intelligent Car Flagship Initiative, where, you know, they're talking about all the different automated systems and, you know, how great they are and, you know, everything, all the benefits for them. But I got kind of like my own little spin on them, I guess. And, you know, there's maybe eight or, you know, so that I want to talk about here. There's a huge list.
Okay.
And I'll quickly go through them. How about this?
All right.
All right. So adaptive cruise control, we've already talked about that one and, you know, some of the pitfalls in that system, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, what about automatic parking? I mean, I guess there's no need to learn how to parallel park anymore. Is that right? I mean, is that true?
Now, you're talking specifically about those parallel parking assistants.
I am. I'm not talking about the Audi system where it lets you out at the curb and then it parks itself.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that one because I think that one's kind of neat. I really.
You're talking about the one that will just park you along the street.
Yeah. Like you get, you know, you find a spot and you get in a kind of a ready position, I guess.
Yeah.
And
that's
interesting. You push a button and then it's hands off and then you're done, right?
See, I like the convenience, but you raise a very good point that people who grow up in a world where every car can do that are really going to suck at parallel parking.
It's going to be a lost skill.
Huh.
Yeah,
okay.
I think that's true. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm not wrong. I hope I'm not right. That's what I meant to say. Because I hope I'm not right with that one. Because I mean, I hope that it's still a skill that's being taught.
It feels like it'll always be. It feels like for a long time that feature will remain prohibitively expensive.
I guess so. All right. Yeah. Well, how about blind spot monitoring? I mean, you know, why bother checking your mirrors anymore? I mean, if it's just going to tell you that someone's there, why bother? And I already see this on the roads.
Yeah.
I already see people just not even looking, you know. But I think that's been around since the beginning of time before there were blind spot monitoring systems. Obviously, there have been, you know, collisions caused because someone was in their blind spot.
Now, Scott, let's make a deal. As you say these, I'm gonna put in my two cents. Sometimes I'll agree with you, sometimes not. Sometimes I'll have another idea because what I've always wanted for a very long time is a way to communicate with other drivers just in like text signs that pop up in my window. I'd love some smart windows on my car. Like, for the people who seem to fall in love with my blind spot, it's like, yeah, I know the Monte Carlo looks great from that angle, you know,
but is that what they're doing? They're checking.
I don't know,
car?
Man. I don't know why they're doing it, but
I'm sure they are.
It's always like a Honda Odyssey, you know, just
of course.
Staying there in the back. And it's tough to navigate around somebody in your blind spot. So I'd love a window message that could pop up and it would say either speed up or slow down. Would, you know, stop jogging with me.
Mm-hmm.
We're not friends.
All right.
And a blind spot monitor. I could see it being useful for larger vehicles. I know it's better to have than not have, but people should be checking their mirrors.
I totally agree. So I will listen to your opposing viewpoints,
okay,
and whether they're valid or not, Ben.
All right.
Fair enough.
Everybody wants smart windows.
Fair enough. How about distance control assist? Now, this is something that Nissan has developed, I think. And again, I mean, is this something that people can't monitor on their own? They can't modulate the speed enough to stay a safe distance? Because I see this on the road every day. Someone is, you know, 4 feet from my bumper when we're going 75 miles per hour.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, then there's the opposite of that. Someone that leaves so much space that people just continually cut in, and it leads to, like, them just going slower and slower, and then it backs up everybody behind them. So I can see this a couple of different ways, but if you have this, this distance control assist, and you're – I almost see it as a way for people to stop paying attention to what's in front of them because it will monitor both ways. You know, it'll say like there's a lot of distance, go ahead and go.
Mm-hmm.
It'll say something's coming up, you know, back it down. So this is almost like the green light to go ahead and,
kick your feet up,
fix your eye makeup or do whatever you're doing, or text or something, right?
Uh-huh. And
not really, but
how does War and Peace end?
That's right. Yeah. Catch up on your reading.
Yeah, I'll,
you see what I mean, Ben?
I see what you mean, but
it makes me seem grumpy when I read this, but honestly, you know, there's so much that's being taken away from the driver at this point.
Just be honest, in the path of autos in the future is going to trend increasingly toward autonomous vehicles, this kind of stuff. But I will say, that kind of distance control is only really useful if everybody has it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so.
So just one car having it is nice, but let's be honest, in a traffic jam, what happens when we've got, you know, like a tailgater who's afraid they're going to run out of turn signals? We all know the type. You and I will see several of them on the way home today. Mm-hmm. What if they are running bumper to bumper, almost kissing bumpers with someone who has this distance control, right? And so that computer says, okay, you have to speed up.
Yeah. And it's got to be freaking the system out.
You know? But there's nowhere for it to go because there's another car in front of
it. Yeah, I don't know. Would it work that way? Would it tell it to speed up if there's something behind it? Or, I mean, I don't
know. Would there be gridlock? Yeah.
I just don't know what the system would do. It's a strange,
anyhow, what's next?
Strange conundrum, Ben.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. A couple of these I'm going to skip. We talked about lane departure warning systems before. I mean, I guess that's something else, but that kind of goes along with the distance control assist and the blind spot monitor and all that. You know, if it's going to tell you all this stuff, then what's the point of even really paying attention? You can only pay like 70% attention, Ben, and just, and get by on that, right?
Well, if you want a good Instagram photo, you have to give your full attention to your phone.
That's a good point.
Right?
Good point. Full attention. That's right. What about, advanced automatic collision notification systems like OnStar? Now, I'm going to say that I actually like this one. This is one that if you crash,
it notifies first responders.
Exactly. They contact you immediately and say, like, is everything okay? Do we need to call anybody? If they don't get any response, they call somebody. This is one automatic system that I actually I'm firmly behind this one. If you don't have to call 911 or no one outside of the vehicle has to witness the accident, even if you're alone on some, you know, desolate stretch of highway and you hit a tree
and you're somehow incapacitated and you can't call.
Yeah, you're knocked out. They know exactly where you are and they know that you need help because you haven't responded to their calls yet. So I think that's a good one.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I actually do like that one. I don't know. Driver monitoring systems, I guess, you know, if the driver's drowsy, I mean, I guess so, you know, you don't have to.
What do you think about like mandatory, breathalyzer things in cars?
Oh, mandatory?
You know, like every car made after 2015 or something has a monitoring system that checks the driver's level of alertness, if they're intoxicated, you know, like on, I guess on booze, but on other drugs as well.
I don't like mandatory anything.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing mandatory. I mean, if you elect to have that, or if you somehow require that by the, let's say the courts require you to have that, understood, then it's in there. I mean, that's your own thing that you have to deal with. I mean, that's something that that's your penalty, I guess.
But you don't think it should be, you don't think that kind of observation of a driver.
I don't want that to be something that has to come in every new vehicle. You know, if I buy a new car, I don't want to have to submit myself to a breathalyzer test every time I get in the car. Even though I know that I'm not drinking or whatever the drug is that it tests for, I don't like mandatory anything.
You have to take a heroin test time just in case.
Yeah, isn't that strange? I mean, yeah, where's it going? Where's the end, right?
Right. Where, what's the bottom of the slippery slope?
Now, let me tell you, Ben, I think, you know, you get the point that I'm a little bit disturbed by the way that, we've talked about this for years now.
Yeah.
By the amount of control that is being taken away from drivers, it seems like every year there's a new system that comes out. We've mentioned a few of those, and some of these are what you call automatic, and some aren't really automatic. I think the focus of the blog post that we originally started with was that, you know, what was formerly a manual control system is now automatic in a lot of cars, and it's kind of progressing to the point where a lot of things are becoming automatic in vehicles that you formerly had to control yourself. And I don't have anything in my car that's automatic. The closest I've got is my rear defroster that turns off after 5 minutes after I push the button. That's it. The rest of it, you know, cruise control maybe, but it's not adaptive cruise control. So I can turn it on or off when I want it.
Yeah.
And I still have to monitor it. Do you
you roll your windows down? How do you roll your windows down?
I roll them down, electrically, yes.
Ben. Oh, look at you.
But that's not automatic. They don't, you know, I don't get in and the car doesn't say it's 86 degrees.
Right.
Oh, you know what? We're in Atlanta. I don't get in the car and it says it's 180 degrees in here. I'm going to decide to roll the windows down for you. It doesn't do that, but I wonder if there is a car that does that. Maybe that's part of the climate control system. It lets out the hot air before it shuts the windows itself.
Perhaps. Maybe. Perhaps. That's something I haven't read about. I think we need to add one important part of that blog post was the implication that this technology, while it exists, is still very much in the early stages. Mm-hmm. So one of the primary operational differences between an automated tailgate avoidance system or collision avoidance system and a human doing it is that the automated system only has a finite or discrete number of variables upon which it can act. So if a situation happens or a variable that it does not understand is introduced, then it's going to behave in possibly very dangerous ways.
So it's not a truly intelligent system yet. And that's what I'm sure our friends at TechStuff talk about this all the time.
Right, yeah.
You know, what's that called? Artificial intelligence. You know, I'm sure that our friends over at TechStuff talk about this all the time. You know, the artificial intelligence and as far as the way it's being put into cars, that's kind of our thing. So we talk about that occasionally.
Right, yeah.
You know, we've mentioned a few of these and they just haven't quite gotten there yet on all of them. I know the Google car that we mentioned earlier, I'm still in trouble saying that. Google car is that's working on it and it's getting there. And it's one of those things that, Ben, I almost have to see it to believe it, really.
Mm-hmm.
To understand that it's truly a safe system and that, you know, you can truly go hands-free with this thing and let it work.
Well, I'm less opposed to the idea of autonomous vehicles, than you are on a personal level. However, I'm more skeptical about some of the timeline stuff, you know, because self-driving cars are going to be more widespread than flying cars. Flying cars, you've won that discussion, my friend, because it's fairly apparent that flying cars are just too dangerous to come out. And the only way they could is if they were somehow autonomous flying cars, if people were hitching rides on drones.
Oh, boy.
Essentially, that's the only way it could happen.
I almost just passed out.
I know. I saw that eye roll. Take your head back.
I'm beginning to get hives right now.
but think about it. That's probably the only way that kind of situation could ever occur. However, autonomous vehicles, these adaptive or automated features are increasingly prized by insurance companies and and they're increasingly being touted as superior to human abilities by car manufacturers. However, I don't know how much of that actually shakes out yet. You know what I mean? I don't know how many of these things are more safe.
Well, you know, as far as the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says,
only two
are worth the extra money, and that was the
adaptive headlights, right?
Adaptive headlights and automatic braking,
ABS,
and those are the only two that they have, you know, concrete numbers backing up that, you know, they save a front to rear collision with.
Yeah.
So far, the rest of them just don't have the dead end. Now, Ben, I'd like to take us back for just 1 minute because there's an early example of an automated system that still causes a little bit of trouble here and there.
What's that?
And this is daytime running lights. And
You
wouldn't necessarily think of this as being a big deal, but there's people that really oppose daytime running lamps. And I'll tell you, I'm not all that crazy about them myself. And there's a good reason. If you just hang in there, I'll tell you why.
I'm in.
There's a business called the National Motorist Association. It's in Wanakee, Wisconsin, which is near Madison, Wisconsin, if you're keeping track of that kind of thing. And, we've got eight, there's an article here that says eight reasons to oppose daytime running lamps. And you know what these are, right? I mean, it's the headlamps that are on all through the day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're at a diminished, capacity, I guess, that, you know, they're running
right.
Like, I don't know if it's like 80% or if it's 60% or whatever it is.
But they're always on. If the car's on, they are on.
Exactly right. And you'll see this in some of the last generation of Corvettes too, where it's like, you know, it's not just the headlamps. It's sometimes it's the, the parking lamps, you know, the orange lamps. And it's just something that's on that garners attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's eight reasons and I'll quickly laundry list these, but the last one is actually the one that I want to get to because it's the one that bugs me the most.
All right.
All right. The eight reasons, and I'm not going to expand on these. They increase visual glare. They obscure the directional signal lights, which, I get that one totally.
Mm-hmm.
They, especially during the daylight.
Yeah.
They increase visual clutter. which means, you know, it can be distracting if there's, you know, some normal traffic flow. I guess it can be distracting. They mask other roadway users.
Yep.
They reduce the conspicuity of motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
They distort distance perception. They reduce emergency vehicle visibility. And the last one, Ben, this is the one that gets me. And tell me if you've seen this before, because I think everybody has had this frustration.
All right.
They can discourage motorists from using standard lights.
Yes.
Now,
yep.
The problem is, now, if you're not familiar with this, now, you have seen this, right? You understand
yep.
what I'm saying?
Yep.
All right. Now, the degree of forward lighting that the DRLs, or daytime running lamps, require, they provide, I should say, is less than a standard headlight, right?
Yeah, it's a diminished capacity.
However, they're still on, and they do provide some type of forward lamp, right?
Right.
So when these things are on all day long, and you're driving, let's say you're driving through the time period when it's daylight and into darkness.
So you're driving during twilight, dusk, or dawn.
Exactly right. Or you could be in your garage and you turn on the car and you see the headlamps on the wall in front of you and you back out.
Like, good to go.
Yeah, everything's fine, right? Because you can still see the instruments inside. I believe the instruments are still lit. And that's part of the problem as well. But when this happens, you know, in these low visibility situations, low light situations, and they forget to turn the lights on fully, you know, to actually make the switch over from daytime running to actual headlamps.
If they still have to do it themselves,
The taillights are not illuminated.
Yeah.
So you're driving around with what, you know, you approach a vehicle from behind on the highway and it look like they don't have their lights on. But as you get to the front of them, you realize that the headlamps are on. And then you have to think, okay, well, this is what's going on. It's daytime running lamps. They don't know it because the headlamps are on. They're getting some type of visibility to the front of the vehicle, but they have no idea that they have no taillights right now. And the only time you'll see a taillight is when they hit the brakes.
Another time when this kind of stuff comes up is, when we were talking about adaptive headlights,
mm-hmm.
I've noticed before that adaptive headlights are very easy for drivers to become acclimated with. Mm-hmm. So it always bugs me when I see somebody driving around at night without their headlights on. And if you live in a city, I understand that it can be easier for some people to forget it.
Yeah, because you come out of a well-lit area.
Right. But it's, dare I say, glaringly obvious when somebody doesn't have their lights on. So I would almost always rather if you can't remember to turn on a light when it's dark, I'm not sure if you should be driving. But I think the light should always be there. But it sounds like what we're talking about again is an early adopter thing, because you're right, Scott. There should not be daytime running lights that are not also adaptive lights. If you're teaching a driver that light's always going to be on, then you, being the engineer, the manufacturer, should also just do the decent thing and not expect them to have to remember normal driving decisions half of the every 24 hours.
This is the thing. You just become acclimated to the idea that those lights are on all
right,
the time.
Right. Like kids today don't know very many phone numbers.
Well, that's true.
Because of cell phones.
I think I've forgotten a lot of phone numbers over the years. I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, my cell phone stores them all. I've become a little bit lazy about it. And I think that's I think that's exactly what happens with this as well. But the danger is that the tail lamps and I don't know if this is true of all vehicles now, because maybe they've adjusted some of them, but early on, and you'll still see these cars on the road, because I encounter them all the time.
Yeah.
Cars that do have the headlamps on, the taillights are out, and it's not just a matter of, you know, that there's a fuse blown or something like that, mm-hmm. or the lamp's out. I mean, I guess it could be, but it's far too prevalent, you know, for that to be the case. I mean, I know when daytime running lights initially were around, when they first mm-hmm. came out, you know, it's kind mm-hmm. of a new thing. That was a big problem. People talked about that specific thing, is that, you know, people are driving around with their, you know, their 50% headlamps on, and it's very dim, but it's working. They can still see. They don't realize that, you know, they're not at full power.
Right.
They don't realize that they're practically invisible from behind at night.
A lot of people, especially if they are not personally interested, if they don't take an interest in cars, they just make ridiculous assumptions. You know, I've seen before people who have assumed that if their car has a problem, they don't drive it for a while and they drive it later, that the problem will go away, that will somehow,
it's gonna fix itself,
get better, you know, like a sick mm-hmm. kid or something. But then also it seems clear and shamefully easy for people who don't investigate too much about their vehicle to just assume that's how lights are supposed to work.
I guess so. I mean, the point here is that, you know, it increases the probability of a rear-end collision.
Absolutely.
And I think it's dangerous, but it's maybe not the case with all brand new vehicles, because I'm assuming that they've, you know, adjusted this, fixed this now at this
right.
point. You know, there's got to be a warning light or something, or a chime or something that tells them, turn on your standard headlights.
Yeah.
I would hope.
Just something like that.
I would
hope. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like with all the other systems we talked about, that's not something that's out of the realm of possibility.
No, that's completely reasonable.
Yeah. And or something that, you know, make sure that, you know, when the daytime running lights are on, that there's also a bit of tail light as well. Even if it's a reduced amount, at least there's something back there. Because right now, I mean, like I said, I've come up on cars on the highway before awful fast.
Yeah.
And then before you realize that, you know, they're even there because they have no taillights on.
Yeah.
No,
and then it's a matte black car.
Yeah.
On a moonless night.
Yeah, exactly.
Worst it's case. True. It's tough to see some of that stuff, you know.
A moonshiner.
It's a moonshiner.
Yeah. No chrome at all.
It's a moonshiner. He's still a Kennedy, though.
Intentionally no lights.
All right. So one other automated system I'd like to mention just as we close. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit debatable, Scott. You ready?
Ready.
GPS.
GPS is automated?
Well, GPS will, if you tell it where you're going, then it automatically tells you directions. It doesn't take control of the car. But you and I, being older gentlemen now, distinguished gentlemen of a certain age, we both remember the days when GPS would come out with, like, they had the Tomahawk product. You remember that was one of the first ones?
Sure.
And the maps weren't always up to date, and people would follow what the GPS told them to do, even if it was driving into a driveway or a wall or over a bridge.
We've heard crazy stories about that. People drive into a lake because the GPS told them to go straight at that point, right?
I mean, talk about authority issues. You know what I mean?
It's really weird, isn't it? You can find news stories about stuff like that happening, whether they're anecdotal or they're true. I'm not sure exactly if some of them are made up or not. Sounds like some of them have to be. They were just so ridiculous.
Well, yeah, there has to be some sensationalism, but the couple that I looked into did hold out and
really?
Were true.
I mean, like the people that turn right and yet it takes them into a coffee shop. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't understand how that's possible.
Collisions.
Yeah, yeah, things
yeah,
like that.
Right about collisions. Well, yeah. I just want to point out that I think, although it's maybe not directly related to what we're talking about, I think that is just as, if not more dangerous, because it's combining the worst aspects of a human being with some of the worst aspects of a machine.
Mm-hmm.
So my nomination for worst driver, worst potential driver, is usually going to involve somebody who is just steering for their GPS.
They just blindly follow the GPS.
Oh yeah, especially in a crowded city, especially in a new city.
You ever
city.
Pull out the old road atlas anymore, Ben? You ever look at the paper atlas?
I do. Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah.
I've got a giant atlas that I sometimes look at, you know, just at home usually. I don't take it with me on the road anymore. I used to.
Yeah.
But I don't anymore. And I've got an older GPS system that also stays in the, you know, in the closet. I rarely use it unless I'm going on a long, long trip and, you know, I feel a little more comfortable having that. But
right.
Mostly that's for points of interest around the roads.
Yeah. And also, depending on what kind of atlas you have, you may be able to find a faster route than what the GPS will indicate you take.
That's true.
That's kind of why I do it. But that may not always be the case, because as we have said, we are talking about a very strange transitional period. And it is quite possible that in the coming decade, this stuff improves dramatically. But Scott, I think there are always going to be people who want to drive their own cars, don't you?
I really do. Yeah. I think there's definitely a firm push back against this type of technology as well from the other side. You know, some people really, really love it and want all of this, you know, instituted immediately if they could.
Right.
And others that say, you know, you can hold off on all of that. I don't even want traction control. I don't want power brakes.
Uh-huh.
I don't want power steering. Just give me a raw car and I want that.
Right. I don't want an enclosed cabin. I feel like that's that's too restrictive.
Exactly right. Yeah. Just give me an engine on a chassis.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a folding chair.
I'll find some wheels.
That's right.
Okay. So which side of this debate do you fall on? Do you think that these adaptive automated technologies at this point show real potential, or do you think they're real problematic? We'd like to hear from you, and one of the best ways to reach us is on Facebook or Twitter. As a matter of fact, Scott, next time we do some listener mail, we ran a little long on this one. Next time we do some listener mail, let's just do it all from Twitter.
Sounds good.
And if you want to be on the air, just hit us up with request for a shout out, idea for a topic, or just a comment. We are CarStuffHSW. And you can send us an email directly after you check out our website, carstuffshow.com. Go and tell us some new topics we should cover in the future. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.